Welcome to another episode of There's Just Something About Kansas City, and he's my old buddy, long time, from Smith Center, Kansas, to the Chiefs Kingdom, the one and only voice of the Kansas City Chiefs, longest tenured voice ever of the Kansas City Chiefs, the one and only Mitch Holtis. Mitch, how are you, my friend?
Awesome. It's great to be with you, Frank. You know, I hearken back to when you're doing those live shows on the field before the game.
Yeah.
Way back in the day. But then to see how far this has come, what's happened in the last 11 years with Andy Reid, with 11 winning seasons, then you look at 8 straight AFC West titles. Like, what planet are we on? 4 Super Bowls, 3 Super Bowl championships, and they're going for another one. They're going to try to make history. Nobody's ever won 3 in a row. This team will have a shot at doing it.
Yeah, right. And you made history yourself as far as, you know, what you've done and what you've accomplished, which I think is fantastic, especially you come from that little small town in Kansas at Smith Center. And we're going to talk about your dad. We're going to talk about home on the range cabin.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about a lot of things. But you were actually born, weren't you? Born, your dad was a military man, weren't you? You were born in the state of Washington, right?
Fort Lewis, Washington.
Fort Lewis.
He was field artillery. So he was stationed in Alaska, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Fort Bliss, Texas, and Fort Lewis, Washington. So about where SeaTac Airport is.
Yeah.
And that's where I was born. Wasn't there very long. They shipped me then with him to El Paso, and then we went back to the family farm in Smith Center. That's all I remember because I was too young to remember all the military moves. But, yeah, we were – that was home.
Yeah, and Smith Center has been home, you know, or was home at that point. I know now you live in the Kansas City metro area. But for you, what was it like growing up in Smith Center, Kansas, tiny little town, and your dad is taking care of the home on the range cabin up there? We're going to talk about that. And everybody knows the music, of course, and the song, but don't realize maybe where it was penned. And it was a poem, started out as a poem, the whole thing. So what? It seemed like it would have been an idyllic life to live in Smith Center, small town, farming community, and the whole thing.
It's a unique place. I'll tell you a story. Like 2 weeks into Andy Reid being here, he goes, it's kind of like, dude, where are you from? And that's just the way Andy is. He wants to try to, he finds out you're Villanova and you're Central Catholic High School. I said, Coach, it's a small town up on the Kansas-Nebraska border. That's the 40th parallel line. I said, but it's famous for 3 things. One, Home on the Range was written there. He goes, yeah, we sang that as a kid in Los Angeles. I go, yeah. I said, 2, it's the county's the center of the 48 states, Lebanon. So sorry, Alaska and Hawaii, but the center of the 48 states is right there. And then 3, I said, great high school football. And he goes, well, I probably recruited there. And I said, yeah, you probably did, because they've had 15 Division I football players. And I said,
wow.
One of the players played for you in Philadelphia. And he stops and he goes, I go, Mark Semino. He goes, Semino was from there? I go, yeah, he's from Smith Center, Kansas. And I said, there was a book written about it, because a New York Times writer had seen that at the time Smith Center had the longest winning streak in Kansas, and they were barreling in on the nation's longest winning streak at the time. And so he went to his publisher and he said, Joe Drape, he's from here. I think he's a Rutgers graduate, but he became an excellent writer for the New York Times. He wrote American Pharoah. But he said, what if I go there and live there for a year? Okay, so he moves from the central west end of Manhattan, New York, not Kansas, and he moves to Smith Center and lives for a year. Here, it's a New York Times bestseller. It's called Our Boys. And I said, Coach, I'll get you the book. I said, it's like $3 or something. He read the book, read it twice. It's an easy read, but he bought that book for the whole staff, because at the beginning, remember, the Chiefs were at the bottom. We were at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
And it's a culture book. Joe Drape did an excellent job of how do you win consistently in football in a town of 2,000 people in a county of 4,500 and have that many Division I athletes. And they've gone different places. The coach there now, Mike Rogers, who's been a part of that program for years and years and years, was a running back at KU. Brooks Barta was one of the leading tacklers in K-State history. He's from there. They had 3 players go to Nebraska. They had a player go to North Texas. It's kind of like you grew up, but it's just in a rural place. So it's Friday Night Lights.
Mm-hmm.
They play in an awesome league. It's the best league in 1-2-3A football. And every year there'll be 1 or 2 Division I athletes out of that league. So it's just awesome. But that's how I grew up. And so that's kind of where the love of football came from, the fact that I was just around it and grew up, and it was cool.
Yeah, and what about your own athletic career?
Very distinguished.
What did you do?
You do everything. When you're in a small school, and it's one of the things that I miss. You know, my son coaches in the Sunflower League now. And he played at Silver Lake in just outside of Topeka. And I did that on purpose. I drove back and forth after I got the Chiefs job. I drove back and forth for 10 years. Tammy, my wife, played at K-State.
Yeah, she's a basketball player. Excellent basketball player.
Really good athlete. But she was coaching there. And then I wanted the kids to have the opportunity, if they wanted to participate, and they're in the 3A level, if they wanted to participate in different sports, I wanted them to do that. So the fact that Lon Kruger's hometown, I'll see him this weekend, actually, but the fact that he could be quarterback of the football team, point guard of the basketball team, and shortstop, center fielder of the baseball team was something that I wanted. And so when you grow up in Smith Center, it's what you, there's just not enough kids. Yeah. And then you, the specialization thing, it's just you can't do it.
It was non-existent.
Non-existent.
At that point.
And even now, some of those kids will play in the summer in a – maybe their sport of emphasis – but they'll still compete in everything else because the school needs them. And they're good in a lot of things in Smith Center. Their women's sports are good. They won basketball a couple years ago. They had a kid that played at KU for a while. And they won volleyball a couple years ago. They're good in track. Right. I mean, it's the culture. It's what you do, and you work. So it's interesting. So Andy now carries on with this. So he was intrigued by this whole Smith Center thing. And he goes, you know, right place and time, I want to see those guys. And so they loaded up in buses at 4 a.m. one morning and drove down. And he looked at him and he said, these kids all work, don't they? Because they all go in and lift at 6. Yeah, they do. But they're not running home and playing video games.
They're out on the farm.
They're out on the farm or working some other job.
Right.
And then they're playing something in the evening. They'll go play baseball. And the cool thing is they just have no fear. They'll come play big city kids. It doesn't matter. And then some of them turn out to be awesome athletes. But – it's just a unique culture. It's a great place. It was a great place to grow up. You learn how to work and respect each other. And it's where my love for sports was.
Yeah, right. That's your work ethic, too.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, coaches, you're talking about how many Division I athletes have. They love a well-rounded athlete. Some people think, well, if you're playing football, you got to, you know, you do this for football. You lift during the offseason, and then you go out and you play, you know, 7-on-7 or whatever you do, and you just – it's all year-round football, all year-round soccer, all year-round basketball, whatever it is. These coaches are looking for a more well-rounded athlete, somebody who has done everything, especially football. They love wrestlers. Coaches love the kids who wrestle, which is, you know, that's another tough sport, and that's just one more thing, so –
Look at our team. Creed Humphrey was an incredible wrestler. Could have been a collegiate wrestler. Decided he was an awesome wrestler in high school. His dad was a national champion in wrestling. But the fact, Creed talks about it all the time, just his leverage. A lot of our offensive linemen actually wrestle.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there's a toughness to it. But you learn leverage and footwork. And it's one-on-one, man. It's mano a mano. Like, you're not – I can't – hey, Frank, help me out here.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Hey, fill my gap over here.
And honestly, Smith Center's had great wrestling. That northwest part of Kansas, north-central part of Kansas – has created outstanding wrestlers.
Yeah.
And I think it's really overlooked in Kansas City, too. I know Dylan Cooper's a kid who wrestled at Mill Valley, was a state champion, and his folks are friends of mine. He's going to wrestle at Arkansas Little Rock. But, yes, they look for wrestlers, and that's an excellent point. But even my son, because some of these sports create cottage industries, right? We all understand that. And I know we're both a little old school. But sometimes we're old school, we're new school, because I will tell you, I see the draft reports. I see the draft evaluations. And if Frank Bowles coming out of Central Catholic in Pittsburgh, and they're looking at the fact that, he was a track athlete and he played baseball, that's actually a plus. And if you look at Patrick Mahomes, the fact that he could have been a Division I point guard, the fact that he was obviously drafted by the Tigers, and he was the football player that he is, but look at all of his skill level. And he'll say, yeah, that's from playing baseball. Dropping his arm slots, but still having power and accuracy comes from playing baseball.
Sure.
So I always tell high school athletes, yes, you have your point of emphasis. Yes, you're a volleyball player, but go do something else too, because it actually can lead to injuries. If I'm just doing the same thing, basketball players, and that's all they do, we got plantar fasciitis all over the place. But run cross country, even though you're not good at it and you hate it, do it, because that'll teach you some toughness going into your other sport.
Yeah, plus the work ethic that you learn in this part of the country, the Midwest.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, you know, Nebraska, Minnesota, all the way down through, you know, Oklahoma and Texas, all the way through this center part of the country, that's where they love that. The work ethic is extremely important. For you, when was the first inkling that you wanted to do what you do? I know you did some in high school, but where was that? Where did that come from? Where did that? I want to. I want to do this. I want to be in sports, involved in sports. I know I'm not gonna be a great athlete, Division I athlete, but I want to be involved.
It was actually on the farm. It's crazy. I could take you back to that farm right now and show
take
you.
Take me back.
I could show you where San Diego was, where New York was, where Oakland was, where Denver was, and where Kansas City was, and they all were different stadia on that farm. And I would now my brothers weren't interested in sports much. They were interested in other things, and they've excelled in those areas. I'm so proud of those guys. But it was me, man. It wasn't let's go get the kids down the block. There was, you know, I'm 10 miles from town. So you create things in your mind, and you're playing that game. Like I was Lenny Dawson winning every game, right? I'm in fourth or fifth grade. So it really started in third, fourth, or fifth grade. I became a sports nut. And at that time, I'd follow the Kansas City A's in baseball, but they weren't very good. I'd ride my bike to the top of the hill with my dog, and so I could pick up KMOX in St. Louis.
The transistor,
right?
Radio.
Yeah, and I'm listening to the Cardinals. Yeah. I'm playing that. You know, so it was all the imaginary things, but you started when you were a little kid. And then in a small town, you got to play everything. And then I got into high school, and I was involved in forensics and debate. And so along with the others, you do a lot of stuff when you're mm-hmm. a small town. And I thought, how do you put these two together? And there was a guy named Tad Feltz at the closest radio station was 30 miles away in Phillipsburg, who was in our travel. But he kind of took me under his wing. And so I started writing and producing and, you know, at a very elementary, rudimentary level, but it started in that way. And then decided to go to K-State and was involved in journalism at K-State. But then I was going to go to law school. I thought about that, accepted to three law schools, you know, did the LSAT, and I'm accepted and the whole bit, law clerk for a couple of years, and then, nah, I don't want to do that.
Oh,
so
boy.
I turned down law school. Oh, yeah. I got my parents' attention. And so then that's when I started my career. But to answer your question, it really started when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Third, fourth, fifth grade, and I was into it, man. I was into all of it, knew all the stats. You know, I wish I would have had the internet back then because I'd have gone nuts. I probably wouldn't have got my homework done at all.
Yeah, right. That's well, that homework, but you're always getting all the you're always getting the I's dotted and the T's crossed when it comes to football. And then you end up, your first job was at KWLS, I think. Mm-hmm. That was in Pratt, Kansas, right? Yep. Which is another small town for a lot of people who watch this from all around the country wondering, you know, wow, I know that voice. I know that guy. I hear him all the time, you know, when the Chiefs play a football game. And then you go from Pratt, I guess, that was your first job, and you end up at WIBW in Topeka, which was probably, you probably felt like a pretty big jump for you at that time.
Yeah.
And that's going to morph into Kansas State football at that point. Right?
Yeah.
Your alma mater, which is terrific.
Yeah, it was awesome. First of all, at Pratt, they're the home of the Miss Kansas pageant. That's their big deal. A lot of cool things happen in Pratt.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the home of the Miss Kansas pageant, and it's a big deal, let me tell you. And so, hey, when I first got there, like, you're going to sell advertising. You know,
you're going to do everything.
Everything, air shift.
Yeah. Be a disc jockey,
You're going to cover, so you're going to cover the towns around there. Although I'll tell you, I expanded it. But then they're going to do the Miss Kansas pageant. I'm going to do what? Like, you know, a sequin gown, like, you know, blue velvet or whatever. And I'm like, it was cool because the whole town got into it and the whole state lit up. But it was, it was interesting. So, but I covered 35 high schools. So I took it from two high schools to 35 high schools. Pratt has junior college in the Jayhawk JUCO. At the time, we were still playing football there. And so we'd play Coffeyville and Butler and seeing all these, like, Mike Rozier type guys. And then we covered all those high schools and then to do everything would wear you out.
Yeah.
But then I had the opportunity at WIBW and get involved then, with the Wildcat Network, still sold the Wildcat Network. I was actually,
isn't it amazing how many, everybody just thinks, oh, he gets to sit up in the booth and do the games and do a little homework during the week.
No.
That's not the way it works. Yeah.
No, I'm selling it. So I had to be, I've always had two or three jobs at once.
Yeah.
Always have had. And so then honestly, it was kind of a dotted line relationship with K-State with marketing then too, because they really didn't have the marketing infrastructure they have now. And so we set a lot of things in place that they enjoy to this day. And so that was an enriching time, also exhausting time. But then the cool thing about it was to see, because we were awful in football, right? We're the bottom of the ocean. So I've lived life twice like that. And then to see the rise, because with Snyder to rise to a national power was like, that was unimaginable. Much like what I've seen with the Chiefs, to be at the bottom of the ocean and rise to be the best team in the NFL.
Yeah, and Bill Snyder, of course, such a amazing presence in the city of Manhattan. He was incredible. He's incredible for me to cover because I went through both the KU and K-State, the two worst teams in football. They're both in the same state, right down the street from one another. That sort of period of time. And then all of a sudden, here comes this guy from an Iowa assistant, older guy a little bit. And everybody's wondering, who is this guy that's going to take over Kansas State football? And the rest is history as far as he's concerned. What an inspirational man.
Yeah. And to be with him for 7 years was incredible. It actually helped me in those 7 years to be with him segue when Coach Reed got here. Now, I went through some rough times with the Chiefs but Coach Reed. But when I saw so much of Coach Snyder in Coach Reed, and I thought, okay. But it helped me being with Coach Snyder for 7 years to understand Coach Reed and what he was doing and how he was doing it. So I'm very thankful for those times.
Yeah, and everybody would say, you had the dream job. I mean, you're at your alma mater for all practical purposes, okay? And I'm doing K-State football, and they've risen from the ashes, and he was this great guy, and I'm here. When I'm sure you probably had offers when you were working for WIBW to go somewhere else, not in to just do – maybe it was Nebraska, maybe it was Oklahoma or whatever. You can talk about it if you like. I'd love to hear some of the stories because I know we've all had offers in our lifetimes to go somewhere else and never did. But you were at K-State, looked like the job. When did you start thinking, did the Chiefs contact you? Did you contact them? Or how did this work when you made the transition?
I had some folks. I even had some prospective agents. But I had some peers going, you need to look at pro ball.
Okay.
And I'm like, yeah, maybe.
Hey, would it have been on your mind at that point?
A little bit.
Or were you looking more like go to a different college?
No, it was pros.
Okay. That was the only thing you looked at. If you're going to stay in college, you're going to stay in Manhattan with K-State, right?
Yeah. In fact, there was some real encouragement to do it. I remember, so I was a finalist for the Bears job. So the Bears were going through some transition. If you remember Wayne Larrivee, who used to do the Chiefs.
Yes, I remember Wayne. Yeah.
Was doing the Bears. He's going to move on to do the Packers. We got to get the timeline right. But I had a really good friend in the business that goes, you need to go for this. Go for this, man. I'm pushing for you. Well, you know how these jobs are. 300 people apply for these jobs. Well, I got down to the interview. And I remember I had done the K-State Tulsa basketball game. It was like one of the coldest days in history. I'm driving to go to Chicago for this interview. Biggest interview of my
life. You're driving from Manhattan to Chicago.
Actually, I was living outside of Topeka then in Silver Lake. But still, it was minus 20 real temperature. It's like it was the Miami game this year in the playoffs, been a real temperature. My car froze up at the 196 mile marker. I know I can't get out of the car. I'm going to die of hypothermia. I got to get to KCI. And I'm like, help me. I put a sign out, help me. And people are just whizzing by me. This guy comes by and he goes, okay. I said, I just got to get to KCI. I'll call and get my car towed, but just get me to KCI because I got to get to Chicago. This guy's going like 100 miles an hour. I'm paying him. Like, I go, let's go. I get to the plane, I get out of there. Now I'm in O'Hare, but I'm trying to get to the. I'm going from O'Hare to WGN in Chicago, which is 635 North Michigan Avenue, and I make it. I look like I've been run through the ringer, but I've got this big interview. But my car's frozen on the turnpike. I've made it to Chicago. I think the interview goes great. They go, "This looks really good. We like your work." I'm thinking, man, life changing stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get back to.
You're calling a tow company to get my car.
No, I'm calling the tow company to get my car. And so I get back. I've got to get – there's no Uber at this time. So I'm paying this guy a cab. I go, can you get me all the way back to Topeka so I can meet my wife? Because I'm supposed to do a banquet that night for Snyder.
Oh, boy.
This is all in one day. So I'm in this old school cab headed west. I see my car being towed going the other way. And I'm like, what's going on? Then that cab froze up. I had to get another cab. I'm not making this stuff up, but I made it to the banquet. I just remember but I didn't get the job. So the long story short is I get to the finalists to be
involved
in WGN.
You go through all this.
I don't get it. So now, though, the Vikings job, these jobs don't open up very often, but I was a finalist for the Vikings. Like, I still have the St. Paul or the Star Tribune. It's down to three people. Okay. I didn't get that one either. And then I filled in for Kevin Harlan the first game of 1991. Kevin was auditioning for NBC at the
time. NBC, that's exactly
right. And so I'm beating out like 70 people to get that. It was the opening game of the 91 year. It was the start of the sellouts. And it might have been the last game before the string of sellouts, but we beat the Atlanta Falcons 14-3. I won't forget it. So I'm working with Lenny, who's my boyhood hero. I'm looking at him thinking.
I mean, you're sitting there.
Oh, I'm wetting my pants. I'm like, this is the guy. You realize that was you every on the farm? I could take you to the farm and show you where San Diego was and all that. So, but I'm thinking, no, be poised. Don't let him think I'm, you know, a moron. So I did that game. But now that game, of course, is my audition tape for these other jobs. Well, now, Kevin, I remember I was at KCI. I'm flying back from some other event in – I got told by somebody that Kevin was going to move on to network television. I can't remember how that happened, but I remember at the carousel getting my bag at KCI and thinking the Chiefs job's opened up.
Yeah, and you're one of the first ones to know.
I'm going, baby, and yes. I'm going for it, but my audition tape is a Chiefs game. Now, think about that. So you know anyway, it was a grind. Perfect. It was a grind, though, man. So I had to fight through the weeds to get it, but that's how
Who else – do you remember who else was up for the job?
I think Twybel was in there. I think Twybel? Carl wanted Twybel, really.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he and Carl were friends.
Oh, they were
close. Yeah.
They were close. Yeah. But the network guys were trying to convince Carl, like, no, this guy can do it. Nothing against Roger.
No,
it's just,
huh?
But it was the people that that had the rights at the time. And so there was this kind of it wasn't a slam dunk.
No. And there are – I don't think people realize this. And I hope you folks out there that have kids that want to get into broadcasting listen to this to understand where you have to go to do. Yeah. But the deal is that you don't understand. There are politics involved here, okay?
Oh,
in a lot of situations, you get down to the final three guys, and all of a sudden, all three guys are just as equally talented to do the job and all do the job the same way and be pros about it and the whole thing. But there is, I think, working with Lenny and Lenny working with you that day, and then knowing the kind of guy Len Dawson is, I know Len would have loved to have heard your stories about, you know, being up in, being small-town Kansas kid. And he loves stories like that. So I think that really helped. I think Lenny had to help you. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
We hit it off right away.
Yeah.
And I miss him. I get choked up. I miss that guy so much. I loved him. He went from like boyhood hero to really good friend, and we had so many great talks. You talk about those stories. Can I tell you, this is one story. So we're playing the Chargers one day, and the special teams coach for the Chargers, because you've heard me do this, I still do it to this day. I research these games deep, but if there's something involved in the kingdom, even with the other team,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to bring it up.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a big deal out of it. Steve Crosby was the special teams coach of the Chargers. Well, he grew up in Pawnee Rock, Kansas. He played college football at Fort Hays State, but he goes on to be an NFL assistant coach, really good special teams coach. And I said, Lenny, special teams coach for the Chargers is from Pawnee Rock, Kansas. You can hear Lenny now. The wheels are – he goes, where's Pawnee Rock, Kansas? I go between Larned and Great Bend on Highway 56.
He goes, where's Larned and Great Bend?
So now I go just south of Zook. You know, this is not a made-up story. We're flying home. This is before GPS. We had it in the seat where, you know, hey, you're 20 minutes out. He always wanted to know where we were. We always sat together. And I could tell – and we're flying back from San Diego. So I knew the flight plan, and I can see Kansas, perfect night. I can see by the lights kind of where we are. And I'm not making this up. He goes, how far are we out? He wouldn't know how far out we were. Where are we at? I go, Lenny, you're not going to believe this. We're at about Pawnee Rock, Kansas. I go, there's Great Bend. I go, there's Larned. That's Pawnee Rock, that little ditty tight legs. And he just started laughing. I go, no, that's it. So, but yeah, that was such a great relationship with him. And so now, and this is a God thing, because my faith's very important to me.
Yeah, it is.
But to go through those twists and turns, but now I'm doing the team that I grew up with. This is my boyhood team, and I love the Chiefs, and I love those games at 3 o'clock in AFL NBC games and Kurt Gowdy and Al DeRogatis, and I'd run outside, and then I'd play the game, and I would go to wherever San Diego was on the farm, or I'd go to wherever Denver was, and I'd play that game, and my mom had me this crudely stitched 16 jersey on. But now I'm getting to do that team. And that kind of carried me through the low parts of the bad seasons, mm-hmm. some of the bad politics. I always had great relationships with our players, but that kept me going through the tough times. But I had chances. I had another chance. I won't say who. Had a chance to go network. But you're going to be like the number five guy. And I'm thinking, what, be the number five guy in a network. The money wasn't going to be all that awesome. And I thought, I really want to be more of leaving a footprint in a place. And
Legacy.
Let's stick this out. And one of the things I'm very proud of is I named the Chiefs Kingdom. I came up with that.
Yeah.
I'm proud of that. People go, did you get that trademarked? I said, no, I wish I would have. I wouldn't be talking to you probably right now. No, but that wasn't the purpose of it, was to make money.
Right.
The purpose of it was to give something definition to
it. I can't believe you didn't trademark that.
Well, you know, it wasn't for that purpose.
I understand.
But
I understand.
It was for the footprint part of it.
Right.
And it did give it – it's now, you know – Pat refers to it, hey, the kingdom. It's the kingdom. We know what it is, and you know what it is.
Oh, everybody.
But
does.
We had to give it some kind of definition.
Everybody probably
they,
in the
they
world.
They call it the kingdom now.
Yeah, they
so,
absolutely.
Anyway, but it became, and they go, wow, dream job. Well, not always been a dream job. But
well, it hasn't always been a dream.
It's been a dream.
Yeah.
And these last 5 years have been a dream.
Yeah.
But still, that carried me through because there was some equity there, emotional equity, because this was my team as a kid.
Yeah.
And growing up with it.
Was there ever a time that you were worried about your job, or do you, or are you like the broadcast mentality? It was every year, I'm worried about getting fired. You know, somebody's going to come in and say, yeah, he's too old, he's too this, he's been here too long. One of those deals. I mean, I know that motivates you to be the best you can possibly be. Yeah. And you have set yourself up in other ways that you really, you are your own entity. You're your own business for all practical purposes. So that's important. But were there times when you worried?
Oh, yeah. It was,
I could tell you exactly probably when, because I can remember general managers and head coaches during those times. But go ahead.
Yeah. You got it. And so you lived in, really have lived in, 3-year increments, basically two, because usually the radio deals that were signed were 3-year deals. And those really are two, because the third year you're worried about, are you going to get the
next? Yeah,
and so you live from jump to jump to jump to jump. But what I tried to do is and this goes all the way back to Pratt, or growing up on the farm and the work ethic, or being broad based and being able to do a lot of things and being able to be the more you can do.
Yeah.
And so if you're the 5-tool player and you can play defense and still hit for average, then you become more valuable than just the guy doing the games. And so that's what I've tried to do. And I think it's – and yes, to build a personal brand as well as the team brand. But it's also getting – and I think that's probably where the essence of what you guys are doing with this podcast is, Kansas City is such a unique place. It is this blend of rural and urban. And we like to think Smith Center, small town, or Pawnee Rock. But Kansas City has still some of that feel to it, and yet it's a city with Major League Sports and the Kansas City Symphony, and we can do great things here. And we live in the center of the country, and we can get great jobs and have a good and you decided to make your career here. Same thing. You could have done other things.
Yeah.
And so but you guys decide to stay here and raise your kids here, and look what happened. I mean, the kids were athletes and had great moments. So that's why I think it's unique. And to build a footprint within that and to make your life count, it's like Psalm 90:12. It's a mosaic psalm, but it's like, teach me to number my days, O Lord, that I might present to thee a life of wisdom, basically. So it's about life. It's not just taking a job. And so, yeah, it's been twists and turns and some narrow escapes.
Yeah. So when's the next contract up, Mitch?
we're in that discussion right now.
we'll make sure you get re-upped.
There's an option here next.
I don't think you're going to have any problem. I asked you about job offers, and I'm sure being a member of Chiefs Kingdom and people hearing you on the NFL Films things and all that sort of stuff, and it's always your highlight, and everything you come up with, and it's amazing. The catchphrases for me are amazing. Where they come from, if they're thought out or if they come out of the clear blue sky, your classic call when Chiefs, touchdown, can Kansas City is just such a classic thing that you hear everywhere when you see a Chiefs highlight. They don't really do the network guys. They always come back to the radio guy who really emphasizes where he is and who this football team is. Where did you come up with that particular phrase?
It came up in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I think I tell Dante Hall, I kind of credit him with it, but it was really like the late 90s days, maybe the end of Marty. But it goes back to a music background a little bit, and I'm not like my younger brother. He's a great musician. His family's all musicians, but think about hard consonants. Mm-hmm. So it's Kansas City. These are hard consonant sounds. This is like the drum beat.
I slur Kansas City. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, you hit goes those right hard through there, yeah. Consonants. And then touchdowns in the NFL are hard to get, and they're to be celebrated. So to do that makes every touchdown come alive more than just one single play.
Right.
And so it really wasn't contrived. It just happened generically. But I thought, man, it's like beating a drum. And people are so excited when a touchdown happens. So it just happened that way. But now what I love, people will, like, I'll be in Hy-Vee and they'll go, do it. I'm not going to do it in Hy-Vee or church.
Because you're
church.
No, the get guy up goes, in the pulpit.
Hey, aren't you the guy? Like, you're the guy, right? I got you. Hey, come on, man. It's cool. We're cool. And he's like, do it, man. Do it. $10 if you'll do it. I'm like, I'm not going to do it in church. Right? So it's just kind of funny. But I'll hear little kids do it.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll see them playing and they'll do it. Or I'll get sent video clips and there'll be a real scent of a kid that's doing it, playing just with their buddies. I'll go, all right, my work is done here. Because a touchdown becomes more than just a single touchdown. To that kid, that touchdown is in his mind, body, and soul is something really cool.
Yeah.
And let's belt it out.
And it's good also, you're working with the Hunt family, and it is the Chiefs. There are a lot of, I couldn't imagine working in Dallas, somewhere like that, even New England, wherever, New York, any of those places where you have solidified yourself as part of the Chiefs, and you coined the phrase Chiefs Kingdom, should have trademarked it, but the whole thing where anybody else would try to step in to follow Mitch Holiness, it will happen way down the line. But I'm just saying, you have solidified yourself as part of the Kansas City Chiefs, part of their fabric, not just a guy up there doing play-by-play for the football game.
And that was the design, and only because you want to make it be – there's such an enthusiasm around the team and the fandom that's always been there, but now it's grown even exponentially with the success we've had. But when you use that as a conduit, Frank, for something else or to make it even kind of a life experience, that's the goal. If you build a personal brand that goes step by step with the team brand, you mentioned the Hunt family. It's the most underrated story of this success run is the fact that with Clark's leadership, the three other kids, with Lamar Sr.'s four kids, if any one of those four decided, hey, I want out, then the other three got to – I mean, the reason we've dominated the division, I talk about this publicly when I speak to corporate groups, is generational transfer. Lamar and Norma did such a great job of – but the kids have actually taken Lamar Sr.'s vision and gone and enhanced
it. And how rare is that?
That is very rare in our society, brother.
All they want to do is cash out and –
Thunder, wonder, blunder, yeah. Grandpa and Grandma were thunder. I don't care if it's rural, if it's urban. Grandpa and Grandma were thunder. Second generation wondered how Grandpa and Grandma did it. And the third generation going to Cabo.
Yeah.
Right, we're cashing out and we're headed out. The Hunt kids, and with Clark leading the way as CEO and chairman and CEO, has taken his vision. Lamar Sr., his mind would be blown to see what's happened.
Yeah.
But the fact of who they are, what they are, how they do it, I'll give you another story. Very few people know this one. It involves Coach Reed. So we're in front of a group. It was AirShare, and it was a small group, people that are AirShare clients. And we were talking about Lamar Sr. and the Hunt family, the same discussion. And he goes, people don't really know this, but when he got the job in Philly in 1999, he had never been a head coach or a coordinator.
Right.
And he had been at San Francisco State, where he's selling, like, cookie dough to
right.
have recruiting budget. Then he goes to Northern Arizona, not a football power. UTEP was terrible. That's where he meets Tobe. And Then he gets the job at Mizzou. He goes with Bob Sills, so they're pretty good. Then he gets to Green Bay. That's his breakthrough. But he was like Favre's guy. But he gets the Philadelphia Eagles job, and the Eagles fans, you know, that are young, are like, what? It's the redheaded
especially
guy.
Especially Philadelphia.
Philly. But they're going, that's the punt, pass, and kick kid. That's what it was.
That's right. Exactly.
And so he goes to the he goes to the meeting where, like, the GMs, coaches, and owners get together, and they hang out at Palm Desert or wherever. And he goes, I'm like I'm the redheaded stepchild or whatever. He goes, people, and he goes, Lamar Hunt came up to me. And he goes, same thing Andy did to me. He goes, like, Andy, congrats, man. Tell me about yourself. He remembered that because now Andy and Tammy have to replant their life.
Yeah, right.
After 14 years in Philly, losing Garrett the way they did. Mm-hmm. Andy's like, where am I going to go next? And it was a land rush to get him. Chargers wanted him. Cardinals wanted, you know,
Everybody wanted him.
But he remembered that conversation that happened 13 years prior because he's thinking, this is a family I could work for. Mm-hmm. This is a family. Well, look what happened. He almost needed the Chiefs as much as the Chiefs needed him because he needed a place to go where he could break through. Oh, he's the guy that always wins the close game, but I mean, can't win the close game and can't win the big one. He's won three big ones. And now, in this environment, working for the Hunt family, he's got a chance now. He's closing in on Belichick to take him out for the most playoff wins ever.
Ever, yes.
And if he's not on Mount Rushmore, then he's on the next closest mountain. Because you got Shula. Mm-hmm. And you got Landry, and you got Lombardi, and there's Andy and Belichick. Like in that next, that's on that one hand.
Yeah,
sorry.
Exactly
and that. So he needed that, but the Hunt family provided that. It's easy to overlook it, but they've been phenomenal, especially doing that generational transfer and to make it even better in the second generation.
I've known you for a long time, and I know you're a motivational speaker. What is your message? And I know you tailor your talks to whomever you speak. You got to know your audience.
Yep.
But what is your bottom line that you try to leave when you walk out of that conversation?
Recently, this has been a popular one, very popular, because people have and this has been national audiences. There was a group, Walmart flew in international leaders. They flew into Kansas City. They wanted to see what's going on there.
Yeah. And then they land to New Airport.
They land to New Airport, and they're like, that's a good thing. But they were like, how are you winning 11 straight years here? It's a little bit kind of the Smith Center story. How do you win in a small town? How do you win in Kansas City? But I've got a message now. I'm learning. What I've learned here in these last 11 years is there's a power from unexpected sources. One is the power of listening. And you know this, being a great interviewer. Great interviewers are great listeners. And it's not just saying to relate it to you. If you said, hey, you know, Garrett's not feeling good, and I go, yeah, Brian's not feeling good either. Wrong answer on my point, my part. I need to ask you two or three more questions about Garrett, right? What more? And to listen, to absorb. Our organization has really done that. Andy does that. And so it's really another undertold story about vertical and horizontally the respect that's there. And it's what you and I both do when we interview. Today I'm being the interviewed, but most of the time I'm the interviewer, is to dive in and listen because then that leads to other stories. Just that's what happened here. It's why you've done this for years and been great at it. But I've learned the power of listening. There's a power to it. There's a power in waiting. The short play, which we – right now, it's just a dangerous time because we're into the short play. Sometimes there's a power of waiting, and I tell the stories which I've related to here. There's a power of purpose. I call it the power of the mangy mutt. It's why we've been able to win and win consistently. It's what I try to do is you stay hungry and humble. And the mangy mutt is not the purebred dog that's going to win best of show. It's going to be your best hunting dog and your best the dog we would have on the farm that had no purebred that was killing possums and snakes and the best dog we ever had. So you want to be the mangy mutt, and you stay hungry and humble, and you stay on task. But there's this power that comes from different places that I have learned that if you put that into the whole person experience, you're never the smartest guy in the room, even though you might be. Mm-hmm. But I learned that from Andy and Pat. Andy's brilliant. He could be CEO of any company in this town, in the country, really. He's brilliant. He plays the whole cheeseburger thing. Mm-hmm. The cat is brilliant, but he never acts like it. And so he absorbs, And then the same way with Pat. Pat is an amazing listener. And people go, God, where does this come from? The guy's got such wisdom. He's 28 years old or whatever, and he'll, you know, he gets asked about the Bucker question. That was such a wise answer. Mm-hmm. And he keeps trying to get pinned down. And he was asked by one person about his slide against the Jets, and it was the trifecta. Like, it was the over-under, and it was the...
Yeah, right. It's
and
exactly right.
He handled that better than I would have. I wouldn't have been handling it really great. But he goes, like, you know, have any of your buddies called you about that? He goes, the buddies that have my number know better than to ask me that. Yeah. So he got across. But these guys are wise because they listen, and they've taught me to try to... there's a power in it.
Yeah.
Because you do build wisdom, and then there's a power in the long-term waiting. So that's... right now has been the essence of my message.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Really awesome. Great to listen to. I'm going to take you back real quick because I want to sort of end with this thing. I know how busy you are. I really appreciate your time today. I'm going to take you back with L. Dean and Catherine Mary, your mom.
Yeah,
okay.
She was awesome.
And your dad, yeah, I'll she bet, was, with all the boys. Awesome. Oh, my God.
God, that woman. She was awesome.
Yeah, so L. Dean comes back from the military, and you move out there to Smith Center, and you're just down the street from the Home in the Range cabin, okay, which I don't know if people realize, Home in the Range was written in this little cabin in right there in the middle of the United States. You can't make this story up, but your dad has been the caretaker of that piece of property for...
Well, there's a long story here. So he, Dr. Higley moves out there, homesteads there, trying to... I don't know if he's getting away from a fifth marriage.
Brewster Higley, Higley.
A little bit of a, you know, he's coming out from Indiana, and he's running, but he homesteads there, and he also likes to write poetry. So he writes the words to Home on the Range, and there's actually a movie made that people can get it that shows this, and I'll walk through the story. He writes a poem. Another one of the settlers shoots himself in the foot. His friend brings the guy there for Dr. Higley to patch him up. His friend reads this poem. He goes, this is plumb good. He said, we need to set this to music. I know an orchestra, Harlan, 20 miles from here. The orchestra's two people, two guys, the Harlan brothers, and they write the music to it.
Uh-huh.
And so then it becomes this cowboy song. But the cabin itself has been there ever since 1872. My great aunt and uncle... My dad's aunt and uncle, my grandma's sister, and her husband basically saved it. They were given a blank check on two occasions because it's such an iconic thing. Think Little House on the Prairie.
Yes,
everybody
right.
sang the song. This is the Cowboy National Anthem, and it's in the middle of nowhere. And this, we're going to move it to some Lotsbury.
Put it on a trailer and put it in some bigger area. Yeah.
And my grand aunt and uncle said, nope, it's going to stay right here. Well, they had no children, so... My dad and his sister helped them set up a living trust. My great uncle dies. My great aunt's left. There's a trust set up, but there's a sunset in this trust that if it hits the sunset and does not go to a 501c3, it could be liquidated. And truthfully, there were some cousins that were like, let's liquidate.
That's what we were talking about before.
Same thing. Mm-hmm. And my dad said, why would you do that if they didn't do it?
Right.
We're going to protect it. So it was a flashpoint. They get a 501c3 set up, People's Heartland Foundation. It's become a game changer. $180,000 were raised to refurbish it. It's the original walls, but we had to refurbish the south wall because it was in disrepair. But it's in historical accuracy. 55-acre hiking and walking trail. The next step, so I do a fundraiser every year, and it's in April. We do a golf tournament, a pickleball tournament, but I fly Chiefs in. Great little airport there, 4,400 feet of runway.
Oh, wow.
Chicken and Pickle, Dave Johnson, Kelly Aldridge. Gosh. They have the Falcon. We use AirShare's Falcon.
Oh,
we fly
nice.
Those guys.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, it's a big deal. And we fly Chiefs in there. This year we had Creed Humphrey, Trey Smith, Echo Boydo came, Felix Anudike Uzama. We've had Trent McDuffie, Mitchell Schwartz. I don't want to leave anybody out. But it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And we raise money. But this year we had a major gift. So here's the next step. On the grounds, we're building an amphitheater. About a $2.5 million project. One of the neat things that we do in Kansas City that I love because it's rural and urban together, remember? The Kansas City Symphony is awesome. But they
I know where you're going. I've been there.
Every summer called Symphony in the Flint Hills. Yes. It's awesome.
It is awesome.
Middle of nowhere, band shell, 7,000 people.
It's on somebody's ranch somewhere down there in the Flint Hills.
In the Flint Hills.
Yeah.
Sells out in 10 minutes.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
The last song they play always is Home on the Range.
And everybody sings.
They all sing it. And I've had tears in my eyes, you know, singing it. So our goal.
Me too.
Is even if we don't have the entire symphony, but think about that being happening then on the actual place where it was written.
Oh, gosh. Awesome.
Think about that.
Yeah.
So our goal now is to build an amphitheater. We have all kinds of cowboy singers that Michael Martin Murphy, remember Wildfire?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He has been a great supporter of the cabin and the grounds.
Right. We saw him one year down in, I think we were in, we were in Cottonwood Falls.
Okay.
And he was performing at the little amphitheater in the city the day before the Symphony in Flint Hills. It was just incredible, yeah.
So he's been great for the cabin. Yeah. But we have these cowboy singers that will show up, and they want to sing the song where it was written. So our plan now, it's a major project, but it's to build an amphitheater there, middle of nowhere, but that'll be part of the charm. Middle of nowhere.
Just
gas up and make the drive. It'll be awesome.
Yeah, and the best thing I've seen, it's open from sunrise to sunset.
Yep.
Every day.
And it's free.
That's just incredible.
Yeah.
So in the winter, real short hours. In the summer, you're there from
long hours,
4:30 in the morning until 9 o'clock, 9:30 at night. So it's just incredible.
So we've had to redo the bridges on the hiking walking trail. We've been talking about having cross country meets out there.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That'd be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
And cross country's big in that area too. So, it's a place where people come. You see the song come alive when you visit the cabin. You see what Higley saw. Because it's just in your mind where the words of the song, but that's so. Tammy and I have worked really hard on that project, and Dad pretty much saved the day.
Yeah, you bet.
But his great aunt and uncle saved the day, and so we're gonna keep it going, even though it's 4 hours away. It's still in the kingdom, man. It's still in the kingdom.
Yeah. The kingdom is everywhere.
It's everywhere.
All right? It's just everywhere. Hey, appreciate you so much coming in, sitting down. Great stories. This is just, and I know how you feel about Kansas City. You talked about it earlier, and it's just an incredible place. And, you know, love being your friend. Love to having you in here, and just continued great luck for you. And we'll try to go out here. I don't know. We'll have to get the copyright on the Home on the Range, but as we go out from this podcast, maybe there'll be a little Home on the Range at the back end of this podcast.
No, let it play. Because it's public domain.
You bet.
Nobody owns it.
Gotcha.
Quick story as we close. So the movie tells a story. So now the song becomes wildly popular. Radio's coming into play.
Sure.
So it's the 1930s, early 1930s. It's FDR, the president. It's his favorite song. He sang it like the lawn. A couple says, we wrote that song in 1912, and they file a lawsuit and a cease and desist order to play it. They want the rights to the song. Something's never changed, Frank.
Right.
They want the rights to the
song. Something about Arizona, right?
Arizona.
It was something about Arizona, yeah.
Arizona.
Okay.
And said, well, my Arizona home. So the Music Protection Agency, this movie does this, and it's a great job. The movie then tells a story. The Music Protection Agency goes, I don't know about this. So they hire a guy named Sam Moenfeldt, who starts to go down a rabbit hole. And he goes, this is blowing way past 1912 when they said they wrote it. And he goes back and he traces it back, and he finds the documentation of a newspaper article where the lyrics were written in Smith County, Kansas.
Wow.
And so if you get a chance to watch this movie, they do an awesome job. And then what I love about the movie is at the end, so they disprove this lawsuit, right? Stand down, go home in Arizona. Yeah. Let's start
singing a song. It's Home on the Range.
And everybody starts playing the song again. But it's public domain. Nobody's made a dime off that song ever, ever.
That's incredible.
At the end of the movie, I love this. It goes back to the cowboy singer singing it live in the radio studio, but then it segues into Michael Martin Murphy singing it in studio in modern times, the group Kansas.
Yes.
They sing it at the end. You see the song, so it goes down through the years. The movie's awesome. I got to get you a copy of it, but get you to download it. But the point is, when you close it out, this podcast, it's public domain, so let it rip.
That's just awesome. Well, that's Home on the Range, and another reason why there's just something about Kansas City. Hey.
Thanks, brother. Right.
You're the best.
Yes, sir.
You bet. Mitch Altus.
Yeah.
Longest tenured voice of the Kansas City Chiefs and the creator of the Chiefs Kingdom. Our guest on There's Just Something About Kansas City.
Home on the range, where the deer and the antelope. the skies are not cloudy. Oh.